Good afternoon, everybody. It is Angie Atkinson, and I am here with the lovely and talented Dana Morningstar. Dana, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Always my pleasure. In case you're new around here, Dana and I do this every Tuesday. Well, most Tuesdays. I hate when I don't mute myself. Most Tuesdays. And we do it, we alternate channels. So some Tuesdays we're here, and then on alternating Tuesdays we're there. That wasn't a very good way to say it. Anyway, usually right around this time, 12:30 Central. I think it's 1:30. What is your time zone, Dana?
Yeah, mine 1:30 Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah. So if you are interested and you would like to join us every week for one of these fun streams, well, sometimes they're fun, sometimes they're serious. we always try to laugh a little bit though. Just subscribe to my channel and Dana's channel, which is Thrive After Abuse right here on YouTube. She's also thriveafterabuse.com, Thrive After Abuse on Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter, all the things. So if you have any questions, let us know. And we are just going to jump right into discussing our little topic for today. Boy, I'm all over the place. I apologize for that. So one of the things, the main thing we want to talk about is narcissists and their double standards, and how I could imagine that everybody watching right now can recall at least one double standard that the narcissist in your life had. In my life, I experienced a lot of this. One of the things that I dealt with a lot was my emotions were not important and didn't matter, and my narcissist's emotions were top priority for everyone in, you know, a 20-mile radius of him. So I found that, you know, I could be completely broken and I would be pushed aside and ignored as though I didn't matter. And this was actually true in both the toxic marriage I was in and the toxic childhood I grew up with. So it's kind of an ongoing thing. And then, of course, if the other person involved in either one of those two relationships became upset about something or had their feelings hurt about something, everything had to stop in the world or else. So, Dana, can you think of a double standard you dealt with in a toxic situation?
Oh, gosh. There's so many. I think the one that stands out to me the most was one of the main relationships that I talk about on here. He was always accusing me of cheating. He would saying he would never cheat. This is so hurtful and blah, blah. And I was going to all these great lengths to prove I was faithful. I had no idea where this was coming from. And then I of course find out later he was cheating with dozens of people, if not even more than that. And how he didn't, there was no resonance with him with that. His attitude was like, well, can you blame me? And I remember it was so immature and so strange. It was everything about it was kind of these expectations only run one way. Like it's just weird when you come across somebody who can vocalize an understanding of a concept, like the need for monogamy, but yet they can't practice it. And when it applies to them, they don't understand why you would be upset with that.
Yeah.
But it's everything, because all of their, that's the core of narcissism. It's just all about them all of the time. And they don't, they can articulate why certain things might be important. Like they expect you to not lie, cheat, steal. They have a moral code, but they don't believe that it holds to them.
Yeah. No, that's totally true. It is. And I used to, for those of you who might be new around here, you may not know the term reactive abuse, but it's when you react to something that a narcissist does by maybe shouting mean things at them or, you know, reactively doing something that might otherwise be called abuse. And I reactively abused my ex by saying, all the time, you're a double standard, have an M or F or. I'm not cussing because we're on YouTube, but y'all know what I really said. I said it out loud to him, and that was mean, but it was true. Everything was double standard for him. And I hate to even say out loud that I did that, but I did it because I was so just overwhelmed, and it was such a heavy burden to carry. So I know a lot of people struggle with the double standards. This article that came out on Psychology Today recently, you know, they talk about several different things, like the grandiose but brittle factor, where they have that larger than life thing. You know, they always want that special treatment and everything else, but then of course they're hypersensitive and they explode if you even look at them cross-eyed, you know. And you know, when they don't get their way or they're not the center of attention, they're going to lash out and cause a lot of trouble for everyone else. You know, and then the fact that they will antagonize anyone in their path, and then, you know, asking, you know, like being brutally painfully critical, and then of course if you even ask them a question that seems too probing, you're attacked. You know, they're desperate for you to listen to them, but they have nothing to hear from you. They won't hear you, or they're bored by what you say. I was told many times that I was boring and I didn't have anything interesting to talk about, and boy, that was fun. And then they said that another one they pointed out was, which I kind of mentioned earlier, they're emotionally entitled, but they don't care about other people's feelings. And they talk about, oh, this one being swift to blame, and then not, of course, owning their own part of the problem. We all can probably relate to that one. And then they talk about being very, you know, so concerned about the way that they appear to other people, self-conscious about their image, but they don't really understand people. They're unaware of the way they affect other people. And I think that one goes a little deeper, but we can certainly, I mean, I can certainly see something in that. I mean, and there are a couple other ones. They're charismatic in public, but ill-tempered behind closed doors. We all know they're all different people behind closed doors. I mean, at least most of them. And then what Dana just said, demanding of loyalty, but quick to betray other people. You know, it's all, and all of these, I can relate to all of them. I'm sure that many of you can too. Dana, what are your thoughts on that stuff?
Yeah, I think the common denominator with it is, it's with narcissists, it's basically a big underdeveloped ego. Mm-hmm. Is what it is. And so that's where that frailty comes from. And that's where that emotional immaturity comes from. Because yeah, most people, this is a stage in normal human development where we are so self-absorbed. Little kids are like this. Yeah. And they grow out of it. They're able to learn the importance of sharing and empathy and compassion and working as a team and taking into account the feelings of other, the wants and needs and feelings of other people. Mm-hmm. But some people, for a wide variety of reasons, just get stuck in this stage of emotional development and they don't grow out of it. And that makes for a really, I don't think there's any really greater emotional pain out there than loving a narcissist or a sociopath, because it's just, you're pouring all of this energy into a black hole. And the level of emotional maturity, you can't have a mature, happy, healthy, well-adjusted relationship with somebody who is the opposite of that, who has this really underdeveloped ego. It requires a level of maturity to be in a mature relationship, and they just don't have that. And so that's why we get to this point where it's like screaming into the wind, where you're continually trying to let this person know, hey, you know, it's not okay for you to, you know, to yell at me or belittle me, or your expectations are unreasonable or what have you. And when a person has that unhealthy ego, they also don't have a healthy sense of boundaries. And that's kind of the bigger problem. And this is where a lot of the abuse comes from, is there's no sense of boundaries with a narcissist, and there's no sense of appropriate levels of control. Like, it's important as adults that we know what we have control over and what we don't have control over. It's important to know where I start and end and where you start and end. And until we have those basics down, our lives will not work. We will continually be frustrated, and there's this enmeshment, there's big time blurring of boundaries, or with boundaryless people like narcissists and sociopaths, they just take and take and take and take and take. And until we can't get them to understand that they have a boundary problem because they don't care.
Yeah.
And so it's up to us to learn how to set boundaries. And oftentimes that means completely cutting contact because they don't get it. And it's just going to, we're going to give everything to them, but we can't, there's not enough love, attention, money, emotional support that you can give a person like that to get them healthy. It just doesn't work like that.
Right. And if they let, you know, if they, if you try to set boundaries with them, they stomp all over them and punish you for that. And that's why you have to go no contact, I think, or at least low contact. At the very least, you have to get yourself to a place where you're not actually like your peace doesn't depend on them. Your daily peace and safety and happiness doesn't depend on them, which means you have to not be in their house. And even if you must deal with them because you have children together or business together or whatever, then you must deal with them only about the business of whatever that is. Personally, I think if you have a business with them, you should work that out to where you get out of it. But if you have children, you're stuck for a certain percentage of time, a certain amount of time up to a point. So, and then you gray rock and you don't give them your emotions, but you certainly, they won't like it when you set boundaries. That's, but that is the, I think the key. And I think in addition to setting boundaries, it's about, I've said this a million times. For me, setting boundaries I didn't really get it until I got it. And what really caused me to go, wait a minute, I have the right to not accept this or whatever, was recognizing that I had value as a person, because I didn't for many years, you know? So I think that's important as well. So I think that's one big part of recovery, is learning your personal value, or, you know, self-acceptance to begin with. And eventually, if you're lucky, self-love. Not if you're lucky, if you intend to make that happen and work toward that, because there's no luck involved in any of this, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Dana, are you ready to jump into the chat?
I sure am. There's lots of great questions going on here.
Yeah, go ahead. You got one to pull up to start with?
Yeah, sure. Here's one from Channel Tools, who asks, is everyone with double standards a narcissist?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think everybody has a little double standard here and there. You know what I mean? But it's, I don't think you have to be a narcissist to have a double standard. Sometimes you just have to have it shown to you, right? And you have to be like, well, somebody might say to you, well, for example, why is it that, you know, you get Sundays off? I don't know, I'm making this up off the top of my head. Let's say you have a boss and you say to your boss, why do you get Sundays off and I have to work every Sunday? That's not a good example. But, you know, then in that case, maybe the boss would go, oh, you know, well, you make a good point. How about we alternate Sundays? I mean, I don't know if that's it's a terrible example, but the point is, personally, I don't think you have to be a narcissist to have a double standard. You might just be unaware that you've kind of fallen into that double standard. What are your thoughts, Dana?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think it helps that you just kind of back up from the term narcissist a little bit and talk about behavior in terms of what's dysfunctional and what's functional.
Yeah.
Kind of like what Angie was just saying, there's a whole wide range of behavior that falls in like the dysfunctional spectrum. And just for clarity's sake, because these words get thrown around a lot and it can be confusing and it can even feel judgmental, like, well, who are you to say what's dysfunctional or functional?
Right.
If you think about the term dysfunctional as it, literally what it means it's not functioning, it's not working. And functional behavior as it's working. So examining your own life as, what behavior are you experiencing or do you have that is either working for you or it's not working for you? And this is what's so challenging with certain personality disorders, is their behavior is causing massive amounts of damage in their life, but they don't see it. So whereas if you're watching these videos and, you know, you're participating in the chat and you're seeing like, gosh, well, you know what? I have some double standards, or gosh, you know what? I've done some of these things too. This is terrifying. Does this mean I'm a narcissist, or does this mean I have borderline personality disorder, or what's going on? We all have behavior that falls somewhere on that spectrum of functional and dysfunctional. And this is the part of the personal growth journey after, especially after a relationship like this, where all of this stuff just kind of comes to the surface. And if we're able to examine it for what it is, and we're actually motivated, we're like, you know what, yikes, I don't want to be this way. That's fantastic. I know it can be terrifying, especially when we see certain behavior, like, you know what, geez, my father was abusive or controlling, or however you want to phrase it. I see certain behaviors in me that are a lot like him, and that's terrifying. But I'm highly motivated to work on them.
Right.
That's the key difference there, is that's the right. Highly motivated to work on them part. And then actually coming up with a plan to move forward to work on them. Right. So,
and then taking action to do it.
Right. Yeah. And in terms of other people, if you're coming across other people that have dysfunctional behavior, it's okay to have limits for this stuff. A person doesn't have to be full out narcissist for you to be like, you know what, I can't have this in my life. So back it up a little bit and figure out what is nourishing for you and what is draining for you, and put limits on what's draining for you.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. Absolutely. And here's, we have so many questions. Yeah. I'm going to grab this one from Darlene Wirtz. She says, will a narcissist ever accept that they are a narcissist and that they need help? And I would say, if they are truly, you know, a toxic narcissist or someone with narcissistic personality disorder, not really. I mean, they might appear to accept it if they need to manipulate you in some way. So let's say you say, look, we're going to counseling and we're going no matter what, or I'm leaving, and they don't want you to leave. So they go to counseling and they play the game for a while. And then they might be like, oh yes, you're right, I need help, I'm so sorry, I'm such a bad wife or husband or whatever. And then of course, once you're comfortable and things start to feel normal a little bit, the narcissist will generally go back to their old behaviors and not, you know, and in fact, maybe even will abuse you for insisting that they go to counseling. You know, that was so stupid, that was such a waste of our time, blah blah blah, you know, or worse. And that's, you know, so I know it's possible. I believe it's possible if a narcissist were to address their core wound and really do the work and really, you know, manage all the things, they could potentially heal, but I've never seen it happen. I don't think Dane has ever seen it. I'm pretty sure every other expert I've ever talked to about this has never seen it. So I don't know. Dana, what are your thoughts?
I think at the end of the day, you know, a porcupine is not going to become a kitten.
Right.
And you're talking, even if they were to identify like their core wound, here's the thing with personality change. Any type of change is really, really difficult. And we all get defensive. So yep. Think about us, okay? Like those of us on the opposite side of the spectrum that tend to be overgivers. When we go and we seek help and we're like, hey, you know what? Our lives are not working. This is what's going on. And we start getting feedback about boundaries and standards and deal breakers and all kinds of things. It's very, very common. People get defensive. I'm not the one with the problem. It's all these other people that have the problem. Mm-hmm. And it takes a person that's an overgiver a long time to even start to see, to even acknowledge, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that. Yeah, I need to set boundaries with people and how to go about that. Yeah. And then it opens up this door, and because it's not just one thing. So we're not asking a narcissist, or we're not, let's call them overtakers for the sake of discussion. We're not asking overtakers or overgivers to just change one thing. It's dozens of things. It's how they interpret the world. It's how they interact with the world. And in order for any of us to have that kind of personality change, you have to stay humble, and you have to be able to look at your own behavior honestly. And that's incredibly difficult for every single one of us, because we all have our reasons for the way that we behave. And because we have reasons for the way we behave, we feel justified in that.
Yep.
And that's what makes it so darn difficult. And those of us on this overgiver side of the spectrum, our lives aren't working. And we're in oftentimes in an incredible amount of pain. we're motivated to get things changed, but that change can only happen so fast. It can only happen with the level of awareness that we have and the ability to work on ourselves. We've got to get better at conflict resolution. We've got to get better at confrontation and boundaries and cutting people out of our lives. It's difficult, and it really takes a person. I mean, change can start to happen on our side of the spectrum instantly, but for a person to really kind of get these skills down, it takes years. Now compare that to an overtaker. They don't experience pain from their actions, which leads to they're not very motivated to change. And then both sides tend to feel really ganged up on, because if you're continually pointing things out, oh, well, you know what, with an overtaker, oh, you know what, you raised your voice and that's intimidating and you belittled me here and I didn't like it when you did this and you did this, they're going to start getting very defensive and like, well, I can't do anything right. You know, you're harping on me, you're manipulative, you're controlling. Mm-hmm. And the overgivers, we tend to feel the same way. People get on us. Oh, what's your boundaries? And you've got to work on this and you've got to work on that. And it just feels like, well, gee, I'm not doing anything right. Like, I'm doing everything I can. I'm reading all these self-help books. I'm going to all these live streams. I'm doing all this stuff. But there's so much to do. It's just overwhelming. So it's, change is difficult. And it's, I guess I just really want to stress the point of, it's important to get a line in the sand of how long, what, getting clear on what kind of changes you need to see another person make and in what time frame, and then holding to that. Because if you're in a relationship with somebody and your whole thought process is this relationship could be so great, possibly someday, maybe, that's a great way to throw away decades of your life.
Yep.
So get really clear so you know when it's time to walk away and not look back. And it's really important that we don't have relationships with people where it's a project. Like, we need them to change all of these major things about them in order for things to work. And at least get clear on where that cut line is.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Absolutely. Do you have another question for us?
I do. We've got one from Life as a Journey who says, can an empath become a narcissist?
Oh, that's interesting. I have the one highlighted in my chat right now. Oh, that's a great one. I would say that a true empath probably cannot. However, what can happen, in my opinion, is you can pick up narcissistic fleas, as they call them, behaviors, even attitudes sometimes. For example, you know, growing up, the way the house was run was by the female in my house, the mother. She ran everything. She was the boss of everyone, including the man. All the decorating was her. Everything was all her. The chore assignments were given as she pleased, you know, like that. Everything was run by her. And so when I first went out into the world, I thought that's how it goes. I thought that's, you know, nobody... I didn't expect my husband or even my ex to be like, well, I want to have something to do with the decorating in the house. I thought, what? How dare you? You know, that's not how this goes. So I had picked up some assumptions about marriage based on something that was unhealthy on some level. Same with attitudes. Like you, if you have a narcissist who is constantly, you know, bullying in their responses. So if they're like, you know, oh, really? Is that how you want to see it? Is that how you want to do it? Or, oh, I see what you're, you know, they're kind of bullying and pushing with the way they respond to people. You know, then you might, after a period of time, pick up some of those bullying responses without even thinking about it. And so those types of things can happen. But the difference, again, is exactly what Dana kind of expressed, is that, you know, when you recognize the problem as an empath or, you know, as someone who isn't a narcissist, even you want to change it and you do take action to make that happen, as opposed to someone who doesn't care or have a problem with the way that they, you know, no, I don't think they can become a narcissist, but I do think that they can develop bad behaviors when in a long-term relationship with a narcissist. Thoughts, Dana?
Yeah, I there's a couple of thoughts I have about this. I think the first one being there's a lot, I've come across a lot of highly problematic people out there. People with a lot of narcissistic and or sociopathic behavior that identify as empaths.
Oh yeah, I've seen that too.
Yeah, and I think some of them honestly do believe that they are very empathic because the ones that really do believe that every single, let me just tell you something, almost every single abuser, if not all of them, believes that they are the victim.
That's true.
And so it's very common for them to think that, you know, boy, they just give and they give and they give and the world is so cruel to them and they just don't understand what's going on. So there's that. There's narcissists and sociopaths and just deeply dysfunctional people running around thinking that they're highly empathic when they're not at all. And you talk to them for a little bit and you just think, you've got to be kidding me. Some of them can hide it for a little bit longer than others. Some of them just slide under the radar, complete wolves in sheep's clothing. They know exactly that they're not empathic. They just understand emotions and how to manipulate. And they know exactly what they are. And they use terminology like empath. And so, because it just helps them get the next target that much easier.
Yeah. That's a valid point.
Yeah. So just be careful out there. Yeah. And then the second point, I'm sorry, I'm on all this cold medicine and I'm not even sure if I'm even making sense. I'm just saying a bunch of words. Okay. Oh gosh. I was so out of it the other day on this cold medicine that I was taking some NyQuil and my alarm was going off on my phone and I was swiping and I couldn't figure out why my alarm wasn't stopping. Then I realized I was swiping my hand.
Oh no.
Out of it I was on this cold. Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
So sorry guys, you gotta just bear with me. The other thing, oh, with empaths is that whenever anybody goes through trauma, trauma is transformative. And the initial transformation tends to be, I would say, for lack of a better term, negative. We tend to see a lot of very different negative changes, personality changes within ourselves. And a lot of that has to do with defense mechanisms. So we tend to have nightmares. We tend to withdraw. We tend to be very guarded and suspicious of other people. We tend to be very reactive.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was actually just going to say something similar to that, because, you know, even just going into kind of dissociation, you know, if you think about the effects, I can't tell you how many times I sat there and watched my phone ring when my best friend was calling me, or I ignored people that I cared about because of the trauma that I was experiencing, and, you know, pushing everybody away from myself and not appearing to care about those people, you know, in hindsight, as you were talking, you know, anyway, it's not who I am as, you know, as a person, but it's who I became for a period of time where I had to kind of shut down in order to survive, if that makes any sense. And I think that was partially dissociation, partially just complete emotional overwhelm. But you're right. These are changes that come to our personalities as part of the trauma. So I guess, you know, from that perspective, you could kind of see how that would appear to be very narcissistic of me from the outside, you know, from someone who I've always been close with, and suddenly I just fall off the planet. That's not like me, but suddenly this is what I've done. And it's unfortunate. I did it. I have to admit it, but yeah.
Yes. And that's terrifying for people when they realize that they're like, oh my gosh, has the abused become the abuser?
Right.
And this is where, you know, it's so important, I think, because without guidance on this, it's so easy for people to just get stuck in that quicksand, you know, of the darkness of all of this. And so it's really helpful to just set the intention that you're not going to let this ruin your life, and that you will in time use what happened to you for your highest and greatest good. And then in more time, using it for the highest and greatest good of others. Even if you don't know how to make that happen yet, just setting that intention and realizing that all of this hurt and anger, this is normal. This is a part of healing. It's a part, it's a part of being hurt. And it's okay. It's okay and normal to have personality changes, but we can just keep walking towards the light, walking towards the direction that you want to head, and deciding that you're not going to let this relationship, this experience define you, that you're going to make the conscious decision to define you.
Yep.
And that's a big part of regaining your power.
Absolutely.
In your life.
Yep. 100%. I have a question here from, wait a minute, where'd it go? Oh, nope. I lost it. Oh, nope. Lost it. Oh, I got it. Mojo asks if you've ever had a narcissist call you a narcissist. Any thoughts?
Oh, I think that's really common for all of the reasons we were talking about earlier. You know,
yep.
They don't understand boundaries. You're mm-hmm. truly dealing with a boundaryless person.
Yeah.
And so when you set boundaries, it's just like a little kid. No, you can't have cookies for dinner. No, you have to do your homework. No, you've got to, you know, no, it's not okay for you to kick me in the shin. No, it's not okay for you to tell me that you hate me.
Right.
You know, when they're acting up, little kids, that does not go over well. They get really upset because that's their way of communicating their frustration or mm-hmm. their wants and needs. They don't have that emotional maturity, you know, and they don't have that concept of what's appropriate behavior. Like, you can't have cookies for dinner because you need something that's more substantial. It's not just because I'm trying to punish you. Like,
right.
You know, but they don't get that. And
that's right.
Narcissists are the same way. So when you say, no, it's not okay for you to cheat on me, or it's not okay for you to yell at me and call me names, because they have their own justifications for it. Well, but you know, you weren't around, or I was, you know, you work too much and that's why I was cheating on you, or I called you names because you frustrated me. You dropped, you forgot to buy milk at the store and you should have remembered that. And that's why I yelled at you. Like, because they have their justifications, they feel entitled to treat other people that way. But a mature person understands it doesn't matter. Like, you can be angry and frustrated. You can, whatever. I still expect you to communicate appropriately. Like, that stuff wouldn't fly at work. Right. I mean, if your boss, had said, hey, I'm going to get you your business cards by Monday, and then they're not there on Monday, they don't go in and start cussing them out and yelling at them.
Right. Not if they want to keep the job.
Not if they want to keep the job, right? Like, it's not right. appropriate. And then even though the boss might have said, hey, I'm going to do this, then come Tuesday, the boss is like, hey, you know what? Your cards came in, they were late, or what have you. Like, there's always this level of appropriate behavior that's just expected in society. And for whatever reason, we tend to make exceptions for it within intimate relationships, which is so twisted.
It's damaging. Yeah. And on that same token, back to the original question of, you know, has a narcissist called you a narcissist? I've seen it a lot. And what I've seen, a couple things. First of all, I want to bring up this comment from Keating Simons, which I was going to mention this, but Keating put it out there. Projection of themselves when they call you a narcissist. Yeah, it's projection up to a point for sure. A lot of times. What I've noticed is if you try to tell a narcissist that they are a narcissist, they research it, and then a lot of them will come back and say, no, no, that's you. You're the narcissist. Of course, I think that's everything Dana said, you know, is completely on point. So yeah, I definitely think that, yeah, that there's something to that. I see it a lot. I see, clients will say, well, so-and-so, you know, he called me a narcissist, she called me a narcissist. And obviously, you know, based on it, none of it matters. It's a label. Dana answered.
And they'll generally call you a narcissist if you try to set boundaries with them or have any issue with their behavior.
Yeah. And this goes right back to your double standards too, if you think about it, because, you know, God forbid you diagnose them with anything, but they will diagnose you with all the things, and including medicine and, all
You're
that.
bipolar. You're crazy.
Right.
You're too emotional. You're too this. You're too that. And it's, yeah, that kind of stuff is crazy making.
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
I
Go
have
ahead.
another question here from Christy, who says, there was just a question on a Facebook group. If all cheaters are narcissists, my opinion is no. What do you think, Ange?
I agree with that, actually. And the reason is because we don't always know every circumstance. Maybe somebody, okay, here's an example. My ex-husband's second ex-wife, or third, I can't recall which one now, cheated on him. And I understood why, because he was a withholder of intimacy. And it was very, very, very painful for me in my relationship with him. And so, and she was with him far longer than I was. And so I understood why she did it. I knew she wasn't a narcissist. She was just desperate for, physical touch and in connection. Was she right to do it? No, she should have left him first. But that's what happened, and I know she wasn't a narcissist, so I don't believe that every cheater is a narcissist. And also, on that same note, I don't believe that every narcissist is a cheater, even though a large percentage of them are. So, thoughts, Dana?
That's a really valid point. Yes. Some narcissists, I think it goes back to, well, okay, sorry. Oh my God. cheating, you could, I think, make the argument that it's narcissistic in the sense that it's selfish behavior, right? You're trying to get your wants and needs met. I agree with you completely. It's context plays into it a lot. We're all better off, shutting one door before we open another.
I agree.
Yeah, I think,
But
yeah, we're on
yeah.
the same page with that. But yeah, there's different circumstances with that. A lot of narcissists are cheaters because this goes with boundaryless behavior. So
Yes.
it's that sense of entitlement. And I guess it would be looking at whether or not this kind of behavior, is it an event or is it a pattern? If it's a pattern, then we've got an issue there. So if
Yes.
it's, like Angie was saying, within the context of this situation, sometimes certain things are like, okay, this is not ideal, but it's understandable. If this is a long-term pattern, another thing. But also, some narcissists are just not very sexual. So the ones that are not cheating, it might not be because they really value monogamy, because they have no boundaries. It's all about them
Right.
all of the time. It's if they haven't cheated, it's because they didn't want to for some reason. They didn't want it to get they didn't want it to damage their public reputation. They didn't they're not that interested in sex. They're who
Right.
knows? Like there's a wide variety, but it's not because they value the other person.
I agree with that. And on that same note, just because they don't have sex with someone else doesn't mean they don't cheat, because there's emotional affairs, there's, secret friends, there's all of this kind of stuff. There's drugs. I mean, I personally think that, if, let's say, the two of you are in a relationship and the narcissist decides, I'm just going to go off and do all these drugs, and this is not what you agreed to as a couple, then the hiding, it's the hiding of the connection to the drug dealer or the actual drugs themselves, and where's the money going? It's almost just like cheating if you think about it. So I think it's all relative. I think even when they don't physically go and cheat, they still cheat in other ways, depending on the person and their own needs, what those are. Like, some narcissists are sex addicts, and some narcissists are, attention addicts. Some narcissists are drug or alcohol addicts, gambling, shopping. I mean, we all have our issues. I'm not saying that only narcissists are those things, but I am saying, and I will say, and I will stand behind this forever. Somebody who is in an active addiction, even if they're not normally a narcissist, will appear to be a narcissist. See, I just went off on a tangent, but it's true.
Yeah,
Anyway, yeah.
it's true. Because if you look at, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, when a person has an addiction of any kind, they're at that base level
Yeah.
of like the physiological needs. And when a person's there, they're just they're driven by that addiction.
Yeah.
There is nothing, you know, love and belonging, safety, like the higher or level order of needs aren't there because they're so driven by that addiction. And it's tragic to watch.
It is. Yeah. Very difficult. Let's see.
Here's another question. This is a good one. This is a great Angie question, I think.
Okay.
Okay. Patty says, what are three quick and easy tips to remind myself of every day that serve as reminders that I'm better off being out of love with a narcissist than trying to fake it alone?
So three quick and easy, are we talking affirmations, reminders, you said?
I think it's just reminders that you're better off being out of love. You're better off being out of a relationship with a narcissist than trying to be in and fake it alone.
Okay. So I think first of all, you know, if you're a single person in a relationship with a narcissist and you feel single because they're not actually engaging with you, or you're a parent and they're not co-parenting with you, they're just existing next to you, then I think, you know, you could, like I used to think to myself, you know, if I'm going to be a single mom, at least I should be allowed to date, which is a messed up thing to say, but that's what I thought to myself a lot back in the day. But no, that's not healthy though. So let me just roll back on that one. I think it's about quick and easy. I mean, I think it's about reminding yourself of your individual circumstances. And one way that I suggest that people do that is when you're in the thick of it, or when you're, as soon as you can, you write down your emotions. Like, you know, if you are being gaslighted, you know, you write down exactly what it is that it feels like. You know, you feel like you're, you know, your throat drops into your stomach and you want to, you know, like whatever it feels like to you, write down the physical feelings, the emotional feelings, and get real detailed with it, and then put it in a drawer and save it for those moments that you doubt yourself. The other thing, I think that's really an important exercise to do. And if you haven't done it and you're already out, do it today, you know, do it as soon as you can, and really kind of dig into those memories and remember how bad it was, because there's this thing, you know, some people call it like abuse amnesia, where the longer you, and other people call it, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder, you know, where you just kind of forget the bad stuff. And, you know, that's why we have more than one child in the world, I guess, because like for me personally, for example, my first child was a C-section without anesthesia. Let me tell you something. That was awful. He is 6 years older than my second child, who was a surprise. But I probably wasn't going to have any more children until I accidentally did. And I'm glad I did, because that kid's awesome. And so is the third one that came after him. But in my case, I didn't really forget completely. But I started to doubt myself. And when I went and had the second child and I didn't have that experience where the anesthesia actually worked on the second child, because I apparently can't have children like normal people. I have to have C-sections because of the way my bones are shaped or something. Anyway, this experience is completely different. And in the first time they said to me, "No, well, you're not really feeling pain. You're just feeling the pressure." I knew for sure I was feeling pain, but I started to doubt myself as the years went on. And so then when I had the second child with a better doctor, who knew what happened to me before, and so was extra careful with the spinal tap thing or whatever they did, I felt that pressure. And yes, it was uncomfortable, but it did not make me scream out loud, "Please God, don't let me die," over and over again. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's a difference. So I guess my point with all of that is that was a different type of trauma, but it was very traumatic for me. And I didn't totally, I knew that it was horrible, but I kind of started to doubt that it really happened the way that it did as time went on. And so if that sort of experience could make, you know, me or anyone, you know, could forget or doubt herself in that situation, then you have to understand that somebody who you loved and were intimate with and were close with, you know, you're away from them for a long time. The things that sucked about that relationship, they get a little quieter in your head. And the things that were good, like in that case, I had that baby, that was good. You know, that stuff kind of gets bigger in your head. And the further away from that trauma you get, the smaller the bad stuff gets and the bigger the good stuff gets in your head. And so that's why I think so often we do slip back in, you know, a couple days away. We're like, oh, but I miss the way, you know, they sing in the shower, or, oh, but I miss, you know, how they smack me on the butt every day, or whatever it is, you know what I mean? Whatever the little things that you liked about that person were, then those things start to come back in your head, as opposed to, and part of that is just because it's normal. You know, you get to the point where you're comfortable with that person, they're your normal. Doesn't mean they're your healthy. It means they're somebody that you're normal with, and mm-hmm. you know, maybe you can fart in front of them or whatever, and you think that's, you know what I mean? I mean, that's a silly thing to say, but it's true. And the idea of dating someone new is awful after a certain point in your life. I'm, you know, nobody wants that. So like, it would just be easier to fix the thing. So there's so many reasons. I guess that's a lot of talking. My point is, don't forget what you went through. And I seriously suggest writing it down. I would come up with an affirmation for yourself. So number one, like for me, if I find myself thinking negative thoughts or things I don't want to think about, I always say to myself, nope, I now cancel that thought and replace it with this affirmation of my true divine desire. And just the act of thinking of that sentence, that whole sentence, it's almost a redirect in itself. It's almost a pattern interrupt in itself. But then I top it off with something positive I do want in my life, as opposed to something negative I don't want in my life. So that would be another thing I would suggest, is that you pattern interrupt whenever you doubt yourself. And then the third thing I would say is, you know, just be real with yourself, and don't, I don't want you to dwell in the abuse. This is why I suggest writing it down and putting it in a drawer. But if you need to pull it out and look at it, then do that. But remember the really bad parts, because those are the parts you can't go back to, you know, and if you're ever going to stay healthy and heal, that's a lot of talking. I'm sorry. I hope I made sense. anyway, thoughts, Dana?
Yeah, I would say, I think you brought up a ton of really great points. For me, one of the things that really helped was kind of getting different like mantras mm-hmm. that I would say. And one of them was, there's nothing there for you. So when I would slip back into that nostalgia and think like, well, maybe I could somehow make this work, or, you know, I would, or, you know, just was thinking of the good times, I'd be like, Dana, there's nothing there. There's nothing there for you. Yeah. All of that, it's smoke and mirrors, and it's just chaos and foolishness, and it's going to bring you nothing but pain. Yep. Like, there's nothing there for you. Yep. So writing those down, I'm a big fan of flashcards, putting different mantras or affirmations on flashcards. Mm-hmm. And I had, at one time, I had a set by my bed and I had a set in my purse, and I would go through them as often as I needed to. Sometimes it was like over a dozen times a day. Wow. And it really helped to rein in my thinking.
Yeah.
Another one was the best revenge is a good life.
I totally agree with that one too.
Yeah. Yep. Another one was, you deserve better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause you do. This isn't, I mean, can you keep a relationship going with a narcissist? You sure could, but why?
Right.
You know, I mean, seriously, and I get it. Like, it's hard when you've got kids and there's money and there's all this stuff, you know, it's commingled. But if you're seriously, for those people that are just dating a narcissist and there's no children and there's no finances and there's no marriage involved, just bench yourself, sit yourself down and be like, what are you doing? Because this will be your life. And they might have a lot of good things about them, but lots of people have lots of good things about them that don't have the abusive side of them. And, you know, don't settle, because it's not, if you're dating and things are already rotten, it's not going to get better when you get married. And it's right. Surely not going to get better when you have kids. The more settled in with them, the more comfortable they're going to be in their behavior.
It's very true. Yeah. And, you know, on that same note, part of the reason that a lot of narcissists, not all narcissists, but a lot of narcissists jump into relationships, because they want to hurry up and get you connected and hooked up and married or whatever it is before you figure out who they really are. I know that sounds messed up, but I really think that's part of it for a lot of them.
And I think a lot of them just, they want what they want and they want it now. Mm-hmm. And I think so much of this is just immaturity, and it's a subconscious thing where, you know, they kind of get you roped in, because we all, you know, when whenever we get what we want, we all just get comfortable. You know, you get the job you want, the pressure's off. People start showing up a little bit late. They start, you know, being more comfortable with how they're dressed. They settle in. We all do this to some extent, but with problematic people, the extent that they do this to is problematic. So, I think that it just goes to show the importance of kind of moving slow, because anybody that has some degree of insight can present fairly well, at least at first.
Yep,
So.
absolutely. I thought of something else while you were talking, and it's just not, it's totally slipped my mind, but I'll come back to it later. It was something I was relating to something you were saying, and I had a, oh well, okay. Your cold medicine's rubbing off on me. I'm just kidding. Okay, I have a question from Milk Dud.
Okay.
Who says, my stepmom is a narcissist. I've decided to cut her out of my life, which has affected my relationship with my father. I am now expecting my first child. Do you think I'm wrong for cutting her out of my life? No, I do not think you're wrong. And if your father can't understand, then I'm sorry, but you're not wrong. And you have every right as an adult to decide who's in your life and who affects your child that you're congratulations, by the way. So no, I don't think you're wrong. And based on everything else that we've talked about today, I think you know I don't think you're wrong. Dana, what do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I would expand on that too, because I think a lot of parents or soon to be parents struggle with this, because it's this fantasy of, oh, but I really want, or it's the obligation, maybe is a better way to say it, about, oh, but I feel obligated to have this person in my child's life. I want my child to know their grandfather. I want their child, my child, to know their father or their mother or whoever the problematic person is. But I think you have to think about it. What is the best thing to do in terms of what is best for that child? And what's best for that child is not just the relational part of it. Oh, knowing their grandmother or their grandfather. It's, is this person going to contribute positively to their life? Or is this person going to be a negative influence? And even if that person is potentially good to the child, if they're planting seeds, if they're disrupting the relationship that you have with the child, and they're gossiping and spreading rumors and telling information that is damage, if they're damaging the relationship that you have with your child, then they really, that's a boundary, it's a big boundary issue, and they're a damaging person. And so then either more boundaries need to be put in place, or actually, more boundaries need to be put in place, whether that means full no contact or wherever you decide. But I think you need to do what's best for your child and the relationship that you have with your child.
I agree with that. And I truly, you know, I think it's just so important. We when we're raised by narcissists or when we're, you know, we spend a lot of time with them in childhood, we don't think we have the right to decide things like that. That's, you know, and I think it's just really important to, you know, you can break the cycle for your child. And, you know, that's been my goal all along for my children, and I'm getting there. I think I'm getting there. I think it's happening. I think they're doing, I mean, I know they're doing far better self-esteem wise and emotionally than I was at their age. Not to say their lives have been perfect, but that, you know, they're growing in some really positive, good ways. So yeah, I think you have the right and in fact the responsibility to do your best to keep toxic people away while you have as you know, because at some point they're going to drive. My son's driving now, and it's you know, at some point they're going to go and do their own thing. And so you know, if you can protect them in their formative years or whatever of the from those negative influences, you're doing them a service as well as, you know, because the fact is, you know, let's say if step grandma gets all up in this child's life and, you know, ingratiates herself with the child and teaches the child all the bad habits and behaviors, and suddenly you're dealing with a narcissist child. I mean, that's not something anybody wants. You know what I'm saying? So just teach your child empathy, do all the things that, you know, maybe weren't done for you. I don't know if the stepmother raised you or not, but either way, I'm guessing that you maybe were a victim which would explain why you would go no contact with her. And so, yeah, everything Dana said, plus that. Well,
and you know, you bring up such a great point, Angie, about and if you're raised with a narcissist or with any degree of dysfunction, and we all have a lot of problematic messages about what's appropriate. Even if we were raised in a fairly healthy family, there's still so many societal ideas about this. Bonnie is saying here in the chat, she said, yeah, I used to think keeping the family together was the most important thing. She said, but my paradigm was wrong. It's necessary to cut out cancer to save your body. It's a lot like that. If there's toxic people in your family, it's important that we are able to be self-protective in whatever way necessary. And for those that have been raised, this is one of those many things we were talking about too, with over givers, how it can take us years, if not decades, these things surface and we're like, oh my gosh, I never thought about it this way. This is yet another area where I didn't realize that I had the right to have boundaries in this area, because my family of origin, we didn't have boundaries with this. It was, if a person's family, their family forever. And we had people coming over who were also boundaryless, who were dangerous and destructive, who were, you know, child molesters, or who were, had active addictions, or who, you know, spoke way, who told our children things that we didn't want them to tell them, or what have you, because it was just the thought of, well, family's family. And so that's part of kind of getting more on that functional side of the spectrum, is realizing, oh my gosh, this is not working for me. And this is my line with this kind of behavior. And the thing that the challenge with this is, especially within like a family, is everybody else might still have that idea of, well, family's forever. And then they're going to get on you about how mean and awful and cruel and abusive you are by keeping distance from certain family members. And so you've got to be able to become grounded enough within yourself and within your own judgment and I'll say discernment. I think that's a better word, with your own discernment and your own boundaries, that you can be in a room full of people that disagree with your decision. But if at the core of you knows, you know what, this is what I need to do in order to stay self-protective and to keep my family safe, then this is what I need to do. It doesn't matter. I don't need everybody else to agree with me.
That's right. And that's hard. It's a hard place to be. But I'm there myself with where my family of origin, you know, and I'll tell you something that's a little bit painful to say out loud again, but here it goes. I wish I could say to you that I left and disconnected from all the toxic people in my life because of myself, but I did not. I did it because of my children in every single case. And that is not okay. You should always, you know, consider yourself. I should have done it for myself. I didn't. I wasn't strong enough for myself. I was strong enough for my children though. And because something happens to me when it comes to them, I get 7 feet tall and, you know, really, like I told my daughter, tell you a real quick funny story. I told my daughter the other day that if this person at school who she was telling me about it, and I felt some kind of way about, I felt worried that it was going to be some, that it wasn't really a true friend. Let me just put it that way. And I said, I sort of joked to her that if this girl did anything to hurt my daughter, that I would come out like Godzilla and burn down the whole town. You know, I wouldn't really do the whole town, but I would come out like Godzilla breathing fire and, you know, 10 feet tall, even though I'm really only 5 feet tall. But, you know, that my point is that I have a lot of us, and for new mama, whose name I can't see in my chat anymore, but the one we were just talking with, it'll happen to you too. You'll get the Godzilla fire in you, mama bear, whatever you want to call it. And then you'll know what to do. And it's easier, I think, when you're doing it for your children. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying you should do it for yourself always. But I couldn't, and I was weak for that. And I, in hindsight, I would have, but at that time I didn't. So there's a little honesty for you.
You know, though, I think, and I'm really glad that you shared that, because I think there's so many people out there that feel so alone in that. And there can be a lot of embarrassment and shame. But I fully believe like that's a stage in our awareness and in our healing. I don't have my own children, but it was for me as a nurse, it was that same kind of thing with my patients over the years. You know, like if they were done wrong or if I saw mistreatment, it was that mama bear, friends, family, anybody, it was anybody else but me. You know, and I would go, I'd, you know, just go to the wall for anybody else. But me, nope, I was completely comfortable with crumbs and being on the back burner.
Same.
And it takes us a while to get in tune with knowing when we're being treated in a way that we're not okay with and making ourselves a priority and learning to balance, to become re in tune with that anger of being mistreated and getting re in tune with that anger in a healthy way to where it's not coming out as just absolute rage. It's coming out as assertiveness.
Yeah.
And that we can set boundaries and just say, hey, this is not for me. Like we don't need to wait until we get pushed to the point that we become Godzilla.
That's right. And that is why, let me just tack this on the end of this. That is why I think it's so, so important to number one, teach your kids at you know, if you do have kids or other kids, people in your life that you affect, teach them empathy, teach them self-respect, self-love, you know, teach them that they are good and that they are, and I mean, by teaching them that they're good, I mean, I grew up thinking I was nothing. I was worthless. I had not, so, you know, years of conditioning I had to undo starting about 9 years ago when I figured all this out. and so, you know, today I'm relatively healthy and I don't put up with much anymore, but it took me a long time to get there. And it took time, and it took, you know, the kids were the catalyst for change, but then I did the work for me, and then I realized, boy, I'm lucky I had those kids, because otherwise I'd still be in that situation, and that was wrong, not good enough for me, as mm-hmm. opposed to me thinking I wasn't good enough for the situation. So that was a big change in the way I was. So my point is, what I joke to my kids all the time, you know, if I knew all the things I'm teaching you now, you know, at your age, I would be ruling the world right now. And that's only halfway a joke, because I do believe I would have been far more successful if I had come out of a place where I had any self-confidence at all when I started in life. You know what I'm saying? And so, and not just self-confidence, but understanding of my sort of place in the world. You know what I mean? Anyway, I think it's powerful to teach your children those things that you wish you had known at their age. I'm finding that really helpful. So do you want to grab one more question and wrap it up, Dana? Or do you have one?
Sure, we can grab one. Let's see here. We got one from Channel Tools who says, how to leave a narcissist if you understand it will be difficult to find another man because you are not so young anymore.
Okay. I'm going to try to, I understand that it's hard to think of the possibility of being alone. However, in my opinion, when you are in a relationship with a toxic person who's actively abusing you, you would be better off alone. And if it's, if, you know, if you can't find, I don't know, I have a perception on this that's different than yours, I think. I don't think I need to have a man in my life to be happy, personally. I think I need someone who's on my team or not. Like, if they're not with me, if they can't love me in the way that I love them, I'm out. And I would be alone and be okay with that. Rather than, it took me a long time to get there, but there was this Whitney Houston song right around the time I was trying to leave my ex-husband, and it was like, one of the lyrics was, I'd rather be alone than unhappy. And that's like a shallow version of what's true, but it's true. It's a valid point. You know, being alone and happy is a real possibility. Being in an abusive relationship where you're being beaten down emotionally and otherwise every single day, not worth it. I guess I feel like you, if I were you, I would really consider how relaxing it could be to be by yourself. myself, and I would consider, is it better to be alone, or is it better to remain in an abusive relationship? I mean, to me, that it's not even a question. And I'm not saying I don't understand how you feel, because I do. I understand the idea of being alone is scary, and it is a thing. What if I can't find someone else because I'm older than I used to be? Because believe me, honey, I ain't getting any younger either, but once again, I have to say, if I had to choose between being alone and having an abuser in my life, I would choose being alone personally. Dana, I hope you have some better insight on this than me.
I know, I agree with you completely. For me, it's the relationship, it has to be nourishing, and it has to be that sense of like mutuality there, where it's nourishing for both people, and all of that. If it's toxic, if it's draining, if it's just emotionally exhausting, if there's abuse, if there's any of that, it yeah, then I'd rather be alone. But I think for channel tools, the way that you phrase this question, the fact that that you're looking at it in terms of, I either stay in this, really deeply unfulfilling toxic relationship, or I'm single, and that the option of being single is awful because that you're needing a man to feel fulfilled. That mindset is worth exploring, because until you get to the bottom of that, if you're looking for another person to complete you, odds are you will continue to find yourself in all kinds of problematic relationships. This is the thing for so many of us, is we don't know how to get to love ourselves, and we don't know how to be alone. And so we're looking towards relationships to fill that void within us. And then we tend to get continually caught up with people that are very quick to give us all of that attention and affection. They're very quick to make us their world. They're very quick to say everything that we need them to say. And then boom, we move way too quick, and then find out, oh my gosh, this person is not at all who I thought that they were. And here I am yet again. How does this keep happening to me?
I 100% agree with you,
Yeah.
and I think that's why when I left my ex-husband, I said to myself, I'm not gonna, I'm gonna wait until, I'm legally divorced, which took a year. I told myself it was gonna be a year. It took 9 months. I waited three more, and before I even thought about dating, because I didn't even know what I was dealing with at that time. But in hindsight, I knew that I was broken, and I knew that I needed time to heal. And I think that you might need time to find yourself. Maybe you haven't found yourself yet, or you haven't recognized your value as an individual. But I personally, I think that there's true value in finding personal space for yourself in the world, and figuring out what you love to do, and finding things
Yeah.
that fulfill you and put a fire in your soul. That's really, really good stuff. And if you haven't done it yet, it's time, my friend. Think about that.
And that, and interestingly enough, that's when these good relationships start to form, because we have dimension to our life. Because so many of us, if we're feeling unloved and unimportant, we get caught up with this person who creates this whirlwind. We're confusing all of this obsessiveness for interest, and all of this intensity for sincerity, and we're misreading all of these cues, and they're making us their whole world, and we have nothing else going on, or very little going on. It helps to stave that off if we have, our own friend group. You're grounded in your own life. You have hobbies. You have things going on where you've built up a life that you really love, and that you're not desperate to find another person in order to feel complete. And then that way you're putting yourself in the driver's seat to where you can focus on being choosy instead of focusing on being chosen. And when you're focusing on being choosy, you're more discerning about you know what's important to you. You're like, hey, I need a person with this kind of spiritual belief, or these kinds of goals, or these kinds of hobbies, or that they're wanting that this kind of dynamic, that this is the kind of relationship that I'm looking for. And if that person comes along, great, it's candles on the cake. But we're not making that person the whole cake.
That's right. Be your own cake, honey.
Yeah, be your own cake.
I don't be, that was a silly thing to say, but it's really true. All right. There are so many questions that I want to answer in the chat, and I will be working on a new series of videos, so I'll throw out what I can. But I would like for you guys to join us next week over on Dana's channel and bring some of these questions back. And we would sit here and talk with you all day if we could, but unfortunately life calls and we do have to wrap up. So before we go, Dana, as always, great discussion, and I appreciate you. And
ditto.
Thank you. Those of you who don't know Dana, Thrive After Abuse, in case you just came in, thriveafterabuse.com, Thrive After Abuse right here on YouTube. Go over, subscribe to her channel. There will be, in the replay, there will be a link to her channel right on this end screen here. And, you know, subscribe, hit the bell notification, and you'll know Dana actually goes live also on Wednesdays. And what time on Wednesdays, Dana?
8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
There you go. And do you have another live, or is that your other main one?
That's the main one. We have a book club discussion the last Thursday of every month, which we actually at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but that's being bumped. We're probably going to end up doing it this Friday. Okay. So come over to my channel if you're interested in that. And you guys, please give a thumbs up if you enjoyed this video and help support Angie's channel.
Right on. Thank you so much. All right, everybody. We will see you next time. And oh, go over to Narcissistic Abuse Recovery by Queen Being channel over where Lisa's. And I think she'll be doing a live stream later today if you guys would like to continue to chat over there. All right. I'll see you guys soon. Okay. Dana, see you next week. Have a lovely week.
Thank you.
All
you
right. My pleasure. Bye. See you later.